Well, in reading the Bible, you will notice that the name Babylon comes up many times. You probably have seen that over the years you've studied and read the Bible. It is never positive in regards to Israel, Judah, or God's people at any time in history. Babylon was once a great and feared kingdom in ancient Mesopotamia. But today, it is a heap of dry bricks and stones in the nation of Iraq. Well, what is the meaning and significance of Babylon for us today, since so much is written about it in the Bible in both the Old and the New Testament? Well, today I'd like to cover the subject of what is Babylon? What is Babylon? And the place to begin in a subject like this is in the beginning of its ancient history, shortly after the Noachian flood. In Genesis chapter 10 is where we first see it mentioned. And of course, Nimrod is the one who, the grandson of Ham, who founded and built the city of not only Babylon, but also of Nineveh. But in Genesis 10:10, it says, "And the beginning of his kingdom, that is Nimrod's, was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar." Now, the land of Shinar is the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what's today Iraq, or was anciently called Mesopotamia. So he began Babel. It's interesting about Babel, that is the Hebrew. The Greek is Babylon, and Babylon was the capital of what later became the kingdom of Babylonia, and also called the Chaldeans as time went on, but it had both names covered the area. And in a lot of cases, by Daniel's time, the Chaldeans may have been the priest caste in Babylonia, because it always talks in the book of Daniel of the priests of the Chaldean priests of Babylonia. That may not always have been the case, though, because we know that later God would bring Abraham out of Ur of the what? Babylonians? No, Ur of the Chaldees. You'll find there. In chapter 12. But coming back here, if we go to chapter 11 and just look at a little of the history of Babylon. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Well, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now, other ancient writings indicate that they were building that so that God would no longer be able to drown the earth and all life, by building it so high that a flood could not cover them up, and they would have a way of escaping God's wrath as they looked at it. Verse 5, "But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they began to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' And so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city." Well, we've come a long way since that time, and man has learned how to, in one sense, get around. It shows you that we're in the time of the end. Get back to the time where man can do things that they really wanted to do in the days of the building of Babylon. So when we look here, another thing about Babylon, what did it picture? What was it? It meant confusion, because God confused their language when they tried to build a tower to extend to heaven. Babel, which in Greek is Babylon, Babel meant confusion in Hebrew. It was the beginning of the pagan forms of worship of Satan following the flood, and it stands for that which is anti-God. And that's why God came down. He was not pleased with what he saw. It became the epitome of all idolatrous worship in the Old Testament. And it all really began there after the flood. It certainly existed before the flood, but it began after the flood in Babylon as far as records that we have. Now, let's go forward 1,500 years to the time of Isaiah the prophet. Because God inspired Isaiah the prophet to write something and write a number of things. In fact, all of the prophets writing about Babylon. And so if we go forward to Isaiah chapter 21, let's take a look at this. Isaiah 21. There is, Babylon was the first of the four great kingdoms that would be discussed by Daniel, given to Daniel in a dream. But before Daniel's time, Babylon is also talked about prophetically. In Isaiah 21, the 21st chapter, of course, is talking about Babylon historically. It's also prophesying in Isaiah 21 what will happen to Babylon from Isaiah's time. And because after Isaiah, Babylon will continue on for another 200 years before it will be destroyed. A lot of times God gives the prophecies a long time in advance of what's going to befall a kingdom or even the world. But in verse 20, chapter 21, and in verse 9, it says, "And look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen." And then he answered and he said, "Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods, and he is broken to the ground." Now that's very interesting what was said there, because that phrase, "Babylon is fallen," is found in the book of Revelation. It's in Revelation 14 and verse 8, and it's in Revelation 18 and in verse 2. The chapter is speaking of the fall of Babylon historically, and that phrase, though, indicates that it is speaking of another Babylon in the future besides just the physical kingdom. The reason why we know that today, of course, is because we have the book of Revelation. We recognize that phrase that Jesus Christ gave to John to record in the book of Revelation. As I mentioned earlier, the kingdom of Babylon continued for another 200 years until about 539 BC, when the Medo-Persian Empire under the rulership of Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon. And, of course, Darius the Mede was ruling with Cyrus, although Cyrus was the more dominant of the two. And it was through and under Darius that the gates, they were able to enter into the city. Now, the city of Babylon was not destroyed, but the government was, and replaced by the Persians. And the city of Babylon continued to be a thriving city for another 1,000 years. And during the time of the first century, the coming of Christ, the apostles, the beginning of the church, Babylon to the east was a big thriving city, and it had not been destroyed. It was not destroyed until the coming of the Islamic invasions in 650 AD. And that's when the city of Babylon then ceased, or began to cease to exist, and today it's just a pile of rubble. King Saddam Hussein tried to restore it for the grandeur of Iraq and all of that, which impressed a lot of our soldiers when they came there in the first Iraq war, and they were to stand guard because it was being pillaged by the locals of a lot of things that had been restored, and they were impressed, and they didn't realize such a place existed. But the rest of it is not restored. It was a huge city. And you can find file photos on it of the many, I don't know what they are, towers or whatever, that are just nothing but eroded bricks. You can't make a whole lot out of it and everything. Because even though the gates of the city have been restored, the German archaeologists took them to Germany, put them in the Berlin Museum probably 100 years ago. Beautiful bricks with their nice glaze blue over them, and the lions of Babylon on the decorated on it. It's all there. Years ago, we had it on the telecast in the World Tomorrow telecast. We used some of that footage. We were able to get permission to go after the Berlin Wall fell to East Berlin, where that museum is, and take pictures of those things that came right out of Babylon. But the rest of the city is nothing but in ruins. Later here in the book of Isaiah, look at chapter 47. Isaiah has quite a bit. I'm not going to go through everything in the Old Testament, but you will read, and almost all the prophets have something to say about Babylon. And here in chapter 47, it's very interesting as well. Chapter 21, verse 9 indicated to us that he was talking about a different Babylon than the one that existed in Isaiah's time. And we get the same indication here in chapter 47, because in verse 1, it begins by saying, "Come down and sit in the dust." In other words, become dust. "O daughter, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate." You're not going to be the great one that you were. Now let's drop down, verse 7 and 8. "And you said that I shall be a lady forever, so that you did not take these things to heart, nor remember the latter end of them. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given to pleasures, who dwell secretly or securely, who say in your heart, 'I am, and there is no one else besides me.'" Now, you recognize that term, "I am"? Jesus said, "I am," didn't he? Where was it here? Listening to Richard Thompson on the FI, Foundation Institute, on he went through this, mentioned what, 7 places in the book of John here recently, going through it on the Wednesday night, although we listened to it on the archives, and it's very good. 7 places in the book of John where Christ says, "I am." And that was how he answered Moses when Moses said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am. I am eternal, always been." Now here we have Babylon taking the title that belongs to God. "I shall not sit as a widow," nor, in other words, "I'll never see death. Nor shall I know the loss of children," as it says here, going on. Now, in Revelation 18, hold your place here. I want you to notice something. Revelation 18 and verse 7. In 18 verse 7, it says, "In the measure that she glorified herself," notice talking here in terms of female, "and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen.'" Remember, it says you think you sit as a lady in Isaiah's account, "and am no widow and will not see sorrow." Well, now, didn't we just read that in verse 7 and 8 back there? Let's go back now. I'm going to switch back and forth here a couple times. Now, if you go back, look at verse 9. "But these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood, and they shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitude of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments." Did you catch that in verse 9? "But these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day." All right, hold your place. Let's go over here to Revelation 18 again. And what do we see? 18 verse 8. "Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her." Well, that's interesting. Look at verse 17. So it's repeated. "For in one hour, such great riches came to nothing." Remember what Isaiah was inspired to write in, what is it, did I get it straight here myself, back in verse 9. "In a moment, in one day." And here it says, "in an hour, in one day." Well, sounds to me like it's talking about the same thing here, is it not? And again, look at verse 19 of Revelation 18, "They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in one hour she is made desolate.'" So in one hour, in one day, very interesting. If you go back, now coming back to Isaiah once again, what is he talking about? Now, without the book of Revelation, we wouldn't pick up on the fact that Isaiah was given. Now, he didn't come up with this. this was being given to him. Who gave it to him? Well, the one who was the God of the Old Testament. It wasn't the Father, because nobody's heard his voice. It was the Son who was giving this prophecy to him and all the others that he had as well. And now in verse 10 here of Isaiah 47, one last verse I'll take a look at. For you have trusted in your wickedness. You have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you. And you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one else besides me. Hey, you are really blind. You are not, I am. All right. So clearly, Isaiah is using phrases here that are very similar to Revelation 18. And he is seeing here in prophecy the New Testament Babylon. And Babylon, of course, is spoken in the New Testament. It's in the book of Revelation. So let's look now at the other Babylon that's spoken of in the Bible. The Old Testament speaks of the historic Babylon and is used as there are prophecies there of not only the historic Babylon, which would fall after the death of the prophets, but also of another Babylon, which is clear to us because of the book of Revelation. Let's go to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation 17, and take a look at this. Now, verse 3 through 5, I want you to notice quite a difference between the Babylon of the Old Testament. Verse 3, so she carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, and having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Well, that didn't sound very positive and very good at all. This Babylon is obviously quite different from that which was described of the Old Testament. Now, here we see a Babylon, as she is called, the Great, but as a woman who is sitting on a scarlet-colored beast. Now, to understand this Babylon, we must understand the symbolic language that is being used here. We must let the Bible interpret its own symbols. And certainly in the book of Revelation and throughout the Bible, it does just that. We don't have to put our own private interpretation or try to read it into the Bible. Now, first of all, when a woman is used symbolically in Scripture, she represents a church. She represents a church. Let's take a look at that. I'll come back here to chapter 17, but in 2 Corinthians 11, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, the apostles understood and they even referred to the true church of God as a woman. And 2 Corinthians chapter 11, and in verse 2, for I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. Paul writing to the Corinthian church, saying that the church of God at Corinth is like a chaste virgin to be presented to your husband, Jesus Christ. So symbolically here, this is referring, there's no question, it's talking about the church when he uses female symbolism. How about the book of Revelation? Does it tell us anything about a female representing a church? Well, let's go to chapter 19. Jesus Christ is speaking here. Revelation 19, verse 7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. Who's his wife? Well, I didn't read it, but you could go back to, I should have read it, I guess, but back in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3, the church is the wife. And of course, he was talking about in verse 2, which I did read, presenting a chaste virgin to her husband. And of course, that's Jesus Christ. But here Christ is calling his wife, a woman, to be his bride. And again, we see that it's the church is represented in terms symbolically as a wife or a woman. Now, look, let's go back now, Revelation chapter 17, we'll go back a page, and let's look at verse 6. Well, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. So what do we have here in chapter 17, verse 6? Well, we have a woman. This is an apostate representing an apostate church that is, quote, drunk with the blood of the saints. Now, if anybody has studied any kind of history in Europe over the last 2,000 years, particularly the Middle Ages into the Reformation period and so forth, or taken Western civilization in freshman college as a freshman 101 and 102, well, you know a little bit about what's been happening or what did happen in the previous two millenniums in Europe. So here we have a church being spoken of. Obviously, it's not the church that Jesus Christ founded in Revelation 17, verse 6. Now, what woman or church would this be? Again, you let the Bible do answer for itself. Look at the last verse of chapter 18. And the woman, which we now know is an apostate or fallen church, whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. All right, that shouldn't be that difficult to understand, because when John wrote this, the only city that could fit that description at that time and through the centuries since that time is Rome. There is no other city. Now, the only church centered in a city that has reigned over the kings of the earth is the Roman Catholic Church, which is headquartered in Rome. Now, some have tried to say, well, it's talking about Babylon. Well, the actual city of Babylon at this time did not reign over any kings in the first century, nor has it ever since. And in fact, today is just a pile of ruins. So that leaves the actual city of Babylon that did exist at the time John wrote this out. It did not reign over anything. If anything, it was reigned over. But that's not the case that you find in the city of Rome. I'd like to share a couple other quotes here from you, because this is not just something from Church of God. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the ISBE, if you want to go by its initials, volume 1, page 391, says this concerning the New Testament Babylon. Quote, the characteristics ascribed to this Babylon apply to Rome, rather than to any other city of that age. A, as ruling over the kings of the earth, 17 verse 18. B, as sitting on seven mountains, 17 verse 9. C, as the center of the world's merchandise, 18 verse 2, 19 verse 2. And finally, D, as the persecutor of the saints, 17 verse 6. Very interesting. Now, let me show you something else about this. It shows how in the first century the New Testament writers wrote concerning the use of the word Babylon. Hold your place here, and we'll go back to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. And as he's ending this letter, he says in verse 12, by Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God in which you stand. Verse 13, she who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, and so does Mark, my son. Now, sometimes people have read that and think, well, did Peter go to Babylon, start a church in Babylon? There were Jews in Babylon who never came back from the captivity, for example, as certainly many others. It was still a populated city. Well, the Jewish New Testament commentary by David Stern has this to say about the use of Babylon in 1 Peter 5:13. Quote, Babylon was a common euphemism for Rome among Jewish writers seeking to avoid censorship and worse. Rome was called Babylon because it was the worst kingdom. See, if you're going to write about Rome, you do not use the name Rome. Why? Because the Roman army occupies the whole Middle East. There is no historical, as the ISBE says, there is no historical evidence of Peter or Mark ever going to Babylon. But there is that Peter passed through Rome, where he was martyred later in his life. Several sources will mention this, not only the David Stern, but the ISBE and other Bible dictionaries, that the name Babylon was used even by the Jewish writers who were not members of the church, I mean, who were of the Jewish community, who when they wrote in their tracts and so forth, they did not use the term Rome. They used the word Babylon as a code for Rome. And this is apparently what Peter is doing here in 1 Peter 5:13. Now, what is the beast that the woman sits on? Remember, she sits on a scarlet-covered beast, Revelation 17 and verse 3. Well, to get the answer, let's go to Revelation 13. Let's take a look at Revelation 13. And in verse 1, Revelation 13, verse 1, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, and having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns were ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now here we have something that is different than the one described in chapter 17, because this beast has ten horns, and it also has seven heads. But remember, the one spoken of, the woman, sat on this beast in chapter 17 and in verse 3. Going forward here, verse 2. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon, Satan the devil, in, used here symbolically, chapter 12, verse 9, the dragon is a type of Satan. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Well, let's take a look at what is this particular beast that we're talking about here. The beast is, like I said, is not a church. It's not a woman here. This is a civil government, the civil government specifically of the Roman Empire. In verse 3, the beast received a deadly wound, and it did. The Roman Empire fell in 476 AD. But it says it was healed from its deadly wound. And guess what? Secular history shows indeed that it was, because it continued on under, as we will see, the name Holy Roman Empire. Well, in verse 1, the ten horns represent, obviously, ten restorations of this empire that were predicted to occur. Ten restorations. Now, what's interesting, the first three were the Vandals. From 429 to 533 AD is when they controlled. They didn't always control Rome at that time, but they did invade and Rome for periods of time. The Heruli, another group of people, from 476 to 493. And finally, the Ostrogoths, meaning the Eastern Goths, from 493 to 554. Those were the first three. Then following those, the next restoration was called the Imperial Restoration. And this is the beginning of where we see the heads. The Imperial Restoration in 554 AD, when Justinian became emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and bringing the Eastern Church and the Western Church together under one authority, and that being, of course, his. There's a difference between those who were came and went of the first three, the Vandals, Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. I'll come back to that in just a moment here. Now we begin the heads, and the heads were crowned. The others were not crowned, which is the difference. Following Justinian's imperial restoration, through succeeding restorations, Catholic popes conferred leadership of the Holy Roman Empire on the following individuals. In 800 AD, Charlemagne, Frankish king, not French, Frankish, which is Germanic. In 962, Otto the Great was crowned emperor of the Roman Empire, Holy Roman Empire. The word holy was put in there. In 1520, 500 years later, Charles V, or Charles the Great of the Habsburgs of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was crowned. In 1805, Napoleon was crowned. Well, he actually took the crown and crowned himself. Took it out of the Pope's hand, put it on his own head, and crowned himself Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He considered himself to be as one of the Caesars. Interesting, there's more written about him than the others that we have any history of, and how he considered himself. And they admired the Roman Empire. They admired the government of Rome, and they admired the authority of the Caesars. The church has said that the sixth head began with the uniting of Italy in 1870 by Garibaldi. But we do believe and have taught that what really fulfilled the sixth head comes down to the Mussolini and Hitler axis of World War II. Mussolini actually declared himself Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Not that I don't know that any crown was directly put on his head, but he certainly claimed the title. And certainly we see from the history and the works of what took place, it obviously was one of the great moments, you might say, in restoration, leading up to the very time of the end. Let's ask the question, well, how did the revived Roman Empire receive the title holy? Why wasn't it just Roman Empire? But now it's the Holy Roman Empire. Well, if you're still here in Revelation 13, look over at verse 11 and 12. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. So we have a second beast here in chapter 13. Verse 12, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Well, this second beast, is the woman of chapter 17, Babylon the Great. She appears as a lamb, that is, like Christ, or appearing to be Christian, but speaks as a dragon, as it says here, or Satan's doctrines. Her teachings and doctrines are not the true teachings of Jesus Christ, but of Satan the devil, contrary to God's way. The second beast crowned the various heads of state as emperors of, quote, the Holy Roman Empire. That's how the word holy was injected. God did not make it holy. The church called it holy. In reality, only God can make anything holy. It's like the Sabbath. It's holy time. Man cannot change it, although he thinks he has. The first day of the week is not holy, because God did not make it holy, and man does not have the authority to make something holy. He may use the word, or I should say misuse the word, but it certainly is not supported and backed up by Scripture or by God. Now, the book of Revelation is not the origin of the prophecy of this union of church and state. If we go back here to the seventh chapter of Daniel, we see where it is prophesied. Back in around 600 B.C., it is approximately 150 years after the time of Isaiah. In Daniel chapter 7, he, of course, was given the ability to interpret dreams, that is, that God gave him the interpretation to give to Nebuchadnezzar of his dream in chapter 2. You come to chapter 7, and now we see this particular dream. Let's start in verse 1. And for the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. And then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. So Daniel spoke, saying that I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Now recall in Revelation 13, what is it, verse 2? One was like a leopard. Here we have it as a lion. And you go back to chapter 2, you have this statue of a person, and the head is the head of gold. And who was the first one always, whether it's Daniel 2, Daniel 7, or Revelation 13? Whether it's gold, lion, or leopard, who's number one? Babylon. Babylon. Then we go on here in verse 3, and four great beasts came up out of the sea. I read that. Let me finish verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Well, this is Nebuchadnezzar. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Well, we know from history and by reading further here into chapter 11, 8 and 11 of Daniel, that it's the Medo-Persian Empire that conquered the Babylonian Empire. 4 great kingdoms that Daniel was given vision of and interpretation of too on different occasions. Verse 6, and after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which we just saw in Revelation 13, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. Well, what happened? You find the interpretation in Daniel 11. Alexander the Great died. This is, of course, referring to Greece. And what happened? His kingdom was divided 4 ways. We see it both in the Bible and we see it in history. But now let's come to verse 7. And after this, I saw in the sight or the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong, and it had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Interesting, just as we saw in Revelation 13, verse 1. I was considering the horns. Well, before I go to verse 8, who's verse 7? You notice that in the accounts, whether it's Daniel 7 or if it's Revelation 13, that the first kingdoms are symbolically animals are used to describe it. Lion, leopard, bear, and so on. But there's no animal to describe the 4th kingdom. It is unusual. It is different from all the others. It can devour all the others. And so you never find an animal used to describe symbolically the 4th kingdom. Coming back here to it, hold your place here. Daniel 2, verse 40, just a couple pages back. Daniel 2, verse 40, the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. What does it say about the 4th kingdom? Verse 40, and the 4th kingdom shall be as strong as iron. Not strong like a lion or a bear, but strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. All the others. The lion, the bear, the leopard, crush them all. And it did. Iron was the strongest thing known to man at that time. They hadn't, of course, developed steel or learned how to develop steel. But iron was the strongest thing that man had at that time. Coming back here to chapter 7, and Let's look at verse 8. We know in verse 7 of chapter 7, here's the fourth kingdom, and history tells us it was the Roman Empire. You really don't need the Bible to figure out which one that is. All you got to do is read any kind of history, and you know the Roman Empire. And it was, of course, in power when Christ came to the earth. But look at verse 8. I was considering the horns. There were 10 of them. And there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words, real pompous words, great things, and really, as we'll see, great things against God. Now, not directly, because that wouldn't deceive anybody, but you might say indirectly. Let's notice something else here. Let's go to verse 24 and 5 of the same chapter, a little bit more information. Now the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, all right? It's going to be restored 10 times from that fourth kingdom. That fourth kingdom is going to have, as we learn in Revelation, it's going to receive a deadly wound, but it's going to be healed. Then it's going to be restored 10 times. Who shall arise? Let's start over again, verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue 3 kings. He's going to subdue those 3 kings, the first 3, which we know from history, Vandals, Heruli, Ostrogoths, at various periods of time there, from 476 to 554, they ruled out of Rome. But this little horn is going to subdue those 3. He doesn't crown them, does he? Notice the difference? They're not crowned. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. Speak against God by teaching things that are anti-God in doctrine. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High. Remember Revelation 17, verse 6? The blood of the saints is on him. And shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a times, indicating the tribulation at the end of the age before the coming of Christ, a martyrdom again will take place. So this little horn would persecute true Christians who would not submit to it, as it says in Revelation 17 and verse 6. Now let's summarize a little bit of this. The little horn of Daniel chapter 7, the second beast of Revelation 13, and the woman who rides the beast of Revelation 17 are all describing the New Testament Babylon, which is the Roman Catholic Church. That's not something that we have the coin on to know that. That has been understood since the first century when the book of Revelation was written. It was always understood down to the period of the Reformation, which would be, 1,400 years, that Babylon was the code used by the New Testament writers for Rome. Erasmus and Calvin, the time of the Reformation, began to teach that it was literally Babylon and that Peter literally went to Babylon. Why? Because the Catholic Church, which they were totally against, said that Peter was the first pope. So you can't say then that, in other words, if it's, they wanted to, in other words, change, instead of saying it was coded, they wanted to take it literally. And it was because of their particular philosophy at the time that certainly Peter did go through Rome. Peter was killed at Rome, but Peter was not the first pope. I have a set of the Catholic Encyclopedia at home. And if you turn to the subject of the popes, Peter is not listed as the first pope. There are names before Peter that I've never heard of before you come to Peter. And where they came from, I haven't the slightest idea. But anyhow, they're listed there. But traditionally, they've always said Peter was the first pope who founded the church in Rome. No, he did not. You'll find in the book of Romans, written by Paul, chapter of 15. I'd have to look it up again, about verse 22, I think it is somewhere in there. He mentions he is not going where any other minister has been. He mentions nothing in signing off, listing all the names of the brethren in Rome. He says nothing about Peter. His name is never mentioned in the book of Romans because he had never been there. Now, he did later come through, but that was years after the book of Romans was written. Now, let's move on here a little bit. What will be the prophesied actions of Babylon the Great before the coming of Jesus Christ? That certainly is very important for us to know, since we have all of this in prophecy to this point. Well, let's go to the Olivet prophecy of Matthew chapter 24 to begin to answer that question. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 21 through 24. In verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." Now look at verse 23 and 24. "Following tribulation," or along with tribulation, "then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." If possible, even the elect. So Jesus Christ gives us a warning about what is to happen. As he says here, "so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect." Let's go over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Because Paul speaks about this time that Jesus Christ prophesied of in the Olivet Prophecy. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And I'll just read verses 3 and 4 here of chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. Verse 3, "Let no one deceive you." And Jesus, what did he say? That many would come to deceive. "Deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Now, let me review. Isaiah 47, more than once, "You say, 'I am,' and there is none beside you." Okay? Daniel chapter 7, speaking pompous words against the, I'd have to go back to it, forgot the word. It's in Daniel 7, verse 25. I just read it, now I can't remember to quote it to you without turning back to it. All of these things. He's talking, obviously, about an office of an individual in a religious system. Now, what's interesting when you look at this, the popes have always claimed the title of Vicar of Christ, which means to stand in the place of Jesus Christ. "I am, and there is none beside me." More than once, Isaiah 47. That, "I am," is Jesus Christ. And the title here is Vicar of Christ, down through the centuries, has been claimed, which means to stand in the place of Christ. The Adam Clark commentary has something to say about this in 2 Thessalonians 2. This man, as he describes this man as, quote, "having the highest place and authority in the Christian church. He acts as God, taking upon himself God's titles and attributes and arrogating to himself the authority that belongs to the Most High." And I believe the term Most High was used there in Daniel 7, verse 25. So many will be deceived by the coming of this individual and the false religious system that will support him. Now, this individual and the religious system that he upholds will come to a very sudden end, spoken of both in Isaiah and in the book of Revelation. Let's go to Revelation chapter 18. Revelation 18. And verse 2. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, right out of Isaiah 21, verse 9, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Let's look at a few other scriptures here. Verse 8. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. In one day, verse 10, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas. Notice people who are witnessing this don't want to get too close. Standing at a distance. That great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in one hour of one day, your judgment has come. Verse 17, for in one hour such a great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance, watching, looking. Verse 19, they threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping, wailing, and saying, Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in one hour she is made desolate. A lot of emphasis here about the sudden destruction. Look at verse 21. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more. Now, this is pretty exacting. Now, who is doing the speaking here? Jesus Christ. John's doing the writing. But it's Christ who's giving this revelation. One day, one hour, that great city will come to an end. Albert Barnes' notes on the Bible are very interesting. If some of you have access to eSword on the computer, you can go to Clark's, Albert Barnes, and others. But his comment on Revelation 18:2 is this, quote, the idea is that of utter destruction, or desolation. And the meaning here is that spiritual Babylon, papal Rome, will be reduced to a state of utter desolation resembling that of the real Babylon. End of quote. Now, since we're here in Revelation 18, let's notice something else. Verse 20 and 24. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Who was martyred at Rome? Well, Paul was, and so was Peter. And they're holy apostles. Verse 24, and in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who were slain on the earth, who didn't agree with her, who did not submit to her, and would not serve her in any way. We find, if we turn now to chapter 19 and in verse 20, talking about this man of perdition that we read that Paul spoke of. In chapter 19 and in verse 20, then the beast was captured, that is the first beast, and with him the false prophet, the second beast. Notice here he's called a false prophet, who worked signs in his presence, in the presence of the first beast, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two individuals were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. Well, this final pope, who is also called a false prophet, and the final head of the restored Roman Empire will be thrown into a lake of fire by Jesus Christ. That's what the Bible says. Now, I'd like to end by going to Revelation back here to chapter 18. There is one verse that we should all take heed to. in chapter 18 and in verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. Now, I believe this would especially apply to the seven churches of Revelation 2 and 3. May all who have known the truth and received God's Spirit heed this warning and come back out of her and out of her doctrines.